welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding health, food, and environmental journalist reporting on Alternet, EcoWatch, and the Huffington Post. I report every week on this show and interview a whole host of thought leaders, experts, scientists, policy analysts, advocates, authors, and more on Connect the Dots, connecting the dots between our personal well-being and the well-being of our total environment, including our communities, our society, the earth, water, air, and food that we have, and the overall ecology of planet Earth. We're trying to reconnect all of the different things that really are part of the greater connectivity of our existence and being, which is so easy to lose sight of. Every week on the show, I bring on different people and we talk about different facets of this, connecting or really reconnecting the dots. Before I introduce today's guest, who has a topic that's very apropos, I need to pause and note that we are now in the second day of a government shutdown caused by, really an attempt to bypass Constitution, democracy, and other institutions with checks and balances to make sure that things pass that reflect public need, want, decision, and opinion. So in response to the Affordable Care Act going into effect, if you're listening to the show today, and later if you listen to it in archives, you'll remember this day. This is the second day of a government shutdown, in effect holding government hostage. So I think it's quite relevant to the theme of today's show, which is and it certainly bears mention because it's kind of the big picture thing that's going on in our society right now. Before we begin, I also have a few comments on it from some of the thought leaders and thinkers that whom I respect on the subject. One thing that's happening, among others, I've done a lot of coverage of oil and gas technology, specifically fracking for natural gas and its harmful environmental and community effects. And so I just want to take a pause and note that as per Think Progress, an online source of news and information that some of you may know, and if not, highly recommended, has pointed out that the national parks are closed to the public due to this shutdown, but that drilling activities and industrial activities, some of which occur even in public park areas, will be proceeding without any a double standard, really, and not one in the public's favor. I want to offer some comments from Carolyn Raffensperger, who is the executive director at Science and Environmental Health Network, and her comments in regard to all of this. One of the things that she points out is that a central responsibility of government is to protect the commons. It's not government's primary responsibility to protect private property, the free market, and everything else. And this shutdown, Carolyn writes, has effectively closed off the commons and is giving a pass to the market. She further sort of sets the stage for a reevaluation and discussion of our theory of government, what it's there for. She points out that both left and right have different critiques of government. The left not happy with the war, spying on ordinary citizens through communications technology like the one we're on today. And she points out that the right believes that the government gets in the way of the free market and therefore they're just, wanting to peel that all away. She argues that it's time to make the case that government has two primary responsibilities: to protect and defend rights, including the right to a clean and healthy environment, and to be the guardian of the commonwealth and common health for present and future generations. I think this is going to have a lot of resonance for today's program, and also something for you to think about in terms of the kinds of priorities we need to ask our government to make and to provide to us. So let's kind of keep that in context as we talk on today's show. And today I'm very, very pleased to have with us Asoka Bhandarage, Asoka Bhandarage is a research scholar, a policy analyst. She's taught at many prominent universities and colleges, including Brandeis, Holyoke, Georgetown, and others. She's written several interesting books, one of which we'll highlight today. And she's also looking at government and the economy, the choices we make from a perspective of environment and sustainability, but also of the economy. And also brings in, kind of a greater spiritual and ethical perspective as well, as I'm sure will emerge in our conversation. Her latest book is Sustainability and Well-Being, The Middle Path to Environment, Society, and the Economy. It's available on Amazon. And her previous book is, which I also want to talk about a little bit, I think it's pretty interesting. Actually, she's quite a few previous books, but she's also written a book on colonialism in Sri Lanka, her native land. Ceylon is, is how some old timers may also remember it. And I think the theme of colonialism is also very central to what we're talking about today. So I'm delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots, Asoka Bhandarage. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, it's wonderful, and it's such an interesting time. Unfortunately, they say, living in interesting times, and our time, in ways great and small, and sometimes really tragic, and sometimes hopeful in terms of breakthroughs to new potentials is certainly an interesting one.
Absolutely, and challenging. Yes,
very, very challenging. I think the quote that I read from Carolyn Raffensperger really kind of presages the theme of your book, Sustainability and Well-Being, The Middle Path. How do you define? I think listeners to this show have a pretty clear or a general sense of what could be meant by sustainability and well-being. We could delve into that a little more as the show goes on, but I think what's interesting is what you define as the middle path, because we're caught right now. In fact, our government is shut down due to divisive conflict and the inability to resolve it. What would a middle path look like?
Right. The middle path concept comes from Buddhism, about avoiding the extremes and moving into a sort of a balanced process in terms of individual liberation, that in order to have our inner peace and happiness, that we have to move away from the extremes, whether it is craving or aversion. But what I'm arguing is that the middle path can also be applied to social transformation, not just sort of individual transformation and liberation. And what I try to do in this book is to apply some of the concepts drawn from the middle path of balance to sustainability and well-being on a global scale. And I think the crux here is the economy. How do we move the economy towards a balanced path? And I think the middle path would be more acceptable to more people than, say, capitalism versus socialism kind of duality. Because the argument is not to say that there shouldn't be any kind of economic growth and that we should move back to a stage of economic stasis, like, during the hunter-gatherer stage where we as human beings spent 99% of our history, there wasn't much change. People lived at the same level for thousands of years. And I don't think that those are the two extremes that we are talking about, either unbridled growth, where there are no constraints on the market or technological development, or stasis. So that's where the middle path comes in, that we can have change, but change which takes into account sustainability of the environment and well-being of people. So what are the criteria, in terms of a balance, the ethical criteria, the environmental criteria, and the social criteria, both in terms of consumption and production. It's not a thesis against any kind of technology. I think we do need better technology like renewable sources of energy, solar technology. So it's not a completely anti-technology or anti-growth position. But I think we have to sort of think these through, you know, in terms of not just technology, but also property relations in terms of ownership. Because right now, you know, we have a corporate structure where, you know, much of... Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. I'm... Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, not just in terms of technology, but in terms of ownership of resources. Mm-hmm. Right now, the ownership, the production and distribution of most goods and services are controlled by a handful of corporations, and that concentration is becoming deeper and wider, and that needs to be looked at in terms of trying to go even beneath the broadening of social inequality, not just among the rich and the poor, but the north and the south, etc. And this is the, you know, the whole model of the economic development needs to be questioned, and we need to balance it more human development of inner development and ethical development, because market and technology are sort of given as the panacea even for solving the environmental crisis and many of the social crises we face, rather than questioning this sort of uncontrolled growth at breakneck speed.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that most people are aware of the downside dangers of unlimited growth?
I think that with consciousness raising, that people can come to understand that, because it's not simply an issue outside of ourselves, because mm-hmm. I think most people are struggling on an individual and personal level to keep up with the pace, you know, that is quickening, that mm-hmm. increasingly we are becoming appendages of the machine, that we mm-hmm. as human beings are becoming dispensable, or we are serving the machine rather than technology serving us. And mm-hmm. most people don't have any time to spare for other people and themselves. So this mm-hmm. is not just sort of growth outside of us, but it is impacting us in terms of the rise in levels of stress, not having enough time to really understand what is happening to humanity, what is happening to our environment. So I think that that our minds are so conditioned by the relentless advertising and the consumerism around us. So that's mm-hmm. why the work that you do, that I do, and so many of us are doing is important, to sort of pause and ask, you know, what is the meaning of life? You know, where are we headed? Because ultimately, you know, and from my Buddhist perspective, I can say that, you know, we have to be in touch with the phenomena of anicca, that our lives are short, they are passing, and mm-hmm. how do we make the best of it for ourselves as well as the future generations?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I completely agree with everything that you're saying. I think that when people do take a step back, as you're suggesting, they do, you know, experience the pressure you're talking about. But I think they don't see a pathway, ready pathway, for how it could be different. So, I mean, I have attended over the years various retreats or gatherings, you know, or people go out into nature, they get a sense of perspective, you know, and then it's always about how do you take it with you and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not only about how do you take it with you on an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about what can people, how can a change take place,
mm-hmm.
You know, given the, you know, the kind of, the way that these forces are sort of in place and driving the situation. I think many people feel trapped and don't really see a middle way through in terms of, you know, what could change, or, you know, how change could come about.
Absolutely, and I struggle with this myself. You know, how do I, as an individual, establish a more balanced middle path in my own life? And mm-hmm. I think that we can't do that completely alone, because mm-hmm. we are social beings and we have to do that in connection with others. And mm-hmm. one of the problems is that our disconnection from each other and from the environment, which has come through this technological and economic advancement, and mm-hmm. so that we have to bring a conscious awareness to where we are at and try to make those incremental changes, which may mean that instead of trying to sort of advance to the highest level we can in one aspect of our lives, you know, which may be in terms of professional and monetary benefits, you know, take some time and energy away from that and from the excessive consumption to spending more time with others, to doing volunteer work. And I think ultimately the crux of the problem of all these issues, you know, including the government shutdown that you talked about at the beginning, is the dualism of self versus other. That mm-hmm. we think of ourselves as separate from others, whereas our sense of self comes from our connection and partnership with others. And I think that that's, you know, what sort of unites all this and the move shift to the middle path.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you completely, and also about the sense, you know, of connection to others being, you know, the greatly enriching experience that humanity's, mm-hmm. you know, has, that people have here on Earth with each other. I couldn't agree more about that. The only thing that I, though, just, you know, do observe as well is that there is, you know, always, you know, if one is completely isolated and alone, obviously that's very sad and disconnected, and, you know, can be a very lonely experience. But, you know, the other part of it is that when we do create bonds, whether bonds through work, through family, through causes that we're involved mm-hmm. with, through hobbies that we have, you know, in all the different ways that we do create bonds, you know, one of the things that happen is that then the next thing is we get loyal to those bonds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so in effect, you know, here with the political parties, you know, we have a group loyal to certain beliefs or points of view, loyal to their group, getting whatever they need, but, you know, disrespectful of other people's needs, to have, you know, their health, their life, their economic supports in place, you know, all of that. So, you know, in a sense, the very thing that could be, you know, and I completely agree with you on that, and is, you know, the real, you know, the thing that binds us can also become, sadly, the thing that separates us, because, you know, I want it for my group and the people I'm loyal to and the people I hang with, and you know, and as for, you know, others, you know, they're shirkers, let them fend for themselves, or, you know, they're outside of my sphere of concern. From a Buddhist perspective, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, because it comes from attachment, and ultimately
right.
the attachment is not even to sort of a cause or a ethno-religious group or political party. Ultimately, the attachment is to the self. And I mm-hmm. think in order to overcome that attachment, you know, which doesn't happen automatically or overnight, but that's mm-hmm. where the middle path comes in, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think we also have to grasp the reality of anicca, or impermanence, that everything is constantly mm-hmm. evolving, that we
mm-hmm.
really can't really hold on to anything
mm-hmm.
permanently, not even our sense of self, not even our bodies or our minds. So
mm-hmm.
I think sort of grounding ourselves in that reality helps overcome that strong attachment to self, which is what the current political and economic order is so built upon, you know, the sense of identity of
mm-hmm.
the self, of our own ethnic groups and political parties, so on and so forth, which also inhibits our developing more of a universal consciousness, because the ego consciousness is so strong. So it's not to say that everyone in the world has to arrive at a sense of universal consciousness in order for us to get through this impasse that we are at, but to strengthen that partnership aspect over the ego aspect, and which doesn't mean that, you know, we have to be completely neglectful of ourselves, because that neglect it comes from a fear and anxiety about, you know, will I have enough food on the table? Will I be able to have enough money in retirement, and so on and so forth? But I think that if we have that a greater sense of connection, that we are all in this together, that if we protect our environment, if we protect each other, that will also provide sustenance for ourselves. So it's question ultimately of strengthening more of that partnership and universal consciousness, and that involves work. But it's also, you know, very exciting to be able to do that, because we are not talking in terms of a very, very narrow political sense, you know. It is also about the inner transformation and the outer transformation together.
You know, I know what you're talking about. I mean, I just, you know, when you talk about the concept of impermanence, you know, I mean, American social values really and seem to be, you know, a bulwark against, you know, any sense of impermanence. I mean, you know, we're trying to nail everything down and kind of make it, you know, as permanent as it can possibly be to protect ourselves and our interests. I mean, so it just seems, you know, not this is playing devil's advocate a bit. It just seems quite a long way to me. I'm, you know, familiar with the concept of impermanence from Buddhism, but it just seems really, you know, a million miles away.
Right. I mean,
for
and
Americans
I'm not talking
to grasp
about
that
everybody
or embrace
just,
it.
Yeah. Being in touch with that, and, you know, we all want security and a sense of stability. But the thing is that we are going to the other extreme, that we think that we can conquer death itself. You know, I mean, as we talk, we have scientists, you know, trying to program robots and bring a human technology connection and create a new kind of sort of post-human species, you know, so that's sort of going to the other extreme. And as human beings, we also want, and as I said, a sense of belonging, a sense of stability and security, which is what a lot of these social struggles are about. And that is where I think the middle path comes in terms of sort of finding a more balanced way, you know, where and it's not even talking about doing away with capitalism or having sort of absolute social equality, but having certain criteria in place, you know, in terms of environmental sustainability, in terms of using renewable sources of energy, in terms of provision of basic needs for people's survival, in, you know, healthcare and education, you know, which gives stability and security to people. But I think what has happened is it's gone to the other extreme, so much so that it is about the stability and security for a few people, and you forget the rest. But in the process, sort of, there is a social and environmental collapse which affects everyone, you know?
What do you think are going to be the key levers to kind of waken people up to this?
I mean, I hope it is not more and more so-called environmental catastrophes. You know, the evidence of global warming and climate change are all around us. And the kinds of environmental disasters that have been predicted are all around us. So already, you know, we are seeing that. And there are hundreds and thousands of people who are suffering from the effects of those catastrophes, you know, about 10 million so-called environmental refugees every year, and predicted to be something like 50 million by 2050. And the people who are most affected by it are the poorest people, the indigenous communities who are much more connected to the environment and live off the land. So I think that that is already happening, which is sort of displacing people, marginalizing people. And it is also giving, and the other lever is the lack of employment, you know, the loss of livelihood. Because of these a confluence of factors, including the environmental destruction, destruction of communities, and lack of employment, which is because the livelihood and provision of a livelihood for people is not factored into economic decision-making. With the increasing mechanization of things like agriculture and displacement of people by robots, large numbers of youth in many countries don't have a place in the economy, and not just the youth, but also the older population, you know, as people live longer. So more and more people, you know, don't have a place as producers and increasingly as consumers. And as they are displaced and as the environment catastrophes increase, which we see happening all around us, you know, people have to take action. And I think that is beginning to happen around the world with the sort of unprecedented wave of environmental activism and particularly climate activism that is happening around the world.
Well, you know, I had sort of two interesting things occur this week in light of, or over the last 2 weeks, I should say, in light of that. On the one hand, I went to the International Women's Earth and Climate Summit, which brought 100 women delegates from all parts of the world together, and they together created a declaration, and they believe that women being more affected by climate and many places living closer to the earth, having traditionally, you know, provided food for their families and all of that through, you know, growing and planting and all the rest of it, you know, these women came together to really share and to organize. And it was a very moving event, and I have to say that I at the event was very, I was there as a reporter, and I was very lucky to spend time with women from various indigenous regions of the earth, and it was very powerful to hear their testimony of how, you know, the river from which they fetched water to grow their corn, that was the traditional staple crop, with water from the, you know, long-standing river that they and their great-grandparents and their ancestors way, way back had always depended on for a simple but stable subsistence, you know, is now dried up thanks to, you know, some of our luxury-prone activities here in the first world. And I have to say that even though I report on all of these topics, this was my first encounter, since I don't have a budget to travel the world very much, with people that were being affected by our activities, and it was really quite a heartbreak. I write about it in an upcoming blog, in fact, but I think many people, most Americans, don't have that experience. They're not only able to, in their minds, you know, kind of put up a mental wall and marginalize people less fortunate or of a different ethnic background in their own country, but what's happening around the world and its connection to both our activities and also to our future well-being is something that I don't think many people are at all in touch with. You know, and the thought would be, well, if they you know, strip the Amazon rainforest, it's unfortunate for the native tribes that are there, but it really, you know, has nothing to do with me. In fact, on an environmental level, that's not so, because that's the home of biodiversity, for example, which means, which does affect, you know, both the future ecological stability of Earth, but also, you know, our food supply, the quality of our air and water, all the rest of it. But we don't really see those connections, and you know, it's pretty sophisticated to see it. Most people are, you know, kind of just concerned about personal health. About a week later, I was with a group of people, and you know, who were concerned, activist, health-oriented, wonderful people, and yet, you know, myself and someone else at the gathering had to explain to them who Bill McKibben, the environmental leader, was. They had mm-hmm. never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's been doing basic organizing around this. So I'm wondering, you know, how you see this penetrating through to the minds of Americans. And I'm going to just leave you to mull that question, because we have to come up to our station break here where we do a station identification. But, you know, let's talk about that in the next
yes.
part of the show. You know, how tuned in, and how can more Americans, and how can more become tuned in? Listeners, stay with us for the second half of my conversation with Asoka Bhandarigay. After these announcements, we'll be back. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you today talking about the middle path to sustainability and well-being with expert author, policy analyst Asoka Bhandarigay. If you've missed the first half of the show, you'll find it later on in the day and from thenceforward in our Connect the Dots show archives on PRN. Please like the show on iTunes if you're enjoying it. Pass it along to your friends. And here we are, and thank you if you were staying with us throughout the show. Here we are for the second half. You know, at the end of the first half of the show, I kind of asked a kind of tough question, and I'm sure it's one that you've thought about a great deal, Dr. Bhandarigay, because I know we're all struggling with it who are concerned about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a great, what I basically delineated in the first half hour at the end of it was a very big gap, a huge gulf between what's going on in the world and to people, and an American ability to empathize and sort of face up to the enormity of what's happening, as well as our participation, without being debilitated by helplessness or guilt. I think in the face of those kind of responses, when we really take a hard look at it, most people instead maybe don't take such a hard look at it. How do we overcome that?
Right, because it's not just with regard to what's happening outside of the United States. I mean, there are mm-hmm. plenty of tragedies, so-called economic, ecological catastrophes, and social problems right in the United States, but
yes.
they are approached as in a very fragmented way. So, for
mm-hmm.
example, the Katrina hurricane happens, or the Sandy storm happens, and
right.
there is a surging of people's emotions and genuine compassion, but it's seen as a fragmented thing rather than as a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the major problems is this fragmentation of issues, and that comes from the sort of dominant way of thinking, which
mm-hmm.
needs to be changed in order to change the culture and the way of life
mm-hmm.
From fragmented thinking to more holistic and interdependent thinking. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's where we have to do the work of raising consciousness and our own awareness, so that this piece of education is a necessary thing in order to make this shift. Which is, you know, as I was saying before, not a shift towards complete selflessness and complete holism, but at least a shift in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, this is the whole basic it's the basic rationale for Connect the Dots, this radio program, is
mm-hmm.
bringing in, you know, all those fragmented pieces that we regard as separate mm-hmm. and considering them in turn and sort of reintegrating them and looking at them together. So I can say personally that, you know, my personal outlook on everything is that this is one of the most important things that we could possibly be doing. When I spent time, as I was describing in the first half of the show, with some of the indigenous tribal leaders at a mm-hmm. recent women's climate conference, you know, it was very clear that they lived within a more holistic worldview,
mm-hmm.
and this was how they perceive reality. Even
mm-hmm.
for me, as you know, as an American, as someone who regards this as important, who set up a radio show
mm-hmm.
so that we could explore that, it's very hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what I hear you saying is that it's all right for us to be sort of works in progress, but what does actually seeing interconnection and holism look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we recognize the signs
mm-hmm.
that we are kind of growing in that vein?
Right, because I think that, first of all, people have to realize that the kind of political economic system that we have at the global level is not working. You know, it's
yes.
not sustainable,
mm-hmm.
and that we need changes. And that doesn't mean, you know, sort of complete shift to an older indigenous way of life, which many people may not want, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
indigenous people have the right to maintain their way of life and their land and their livelihood, but a lot of people, you know, who lived in a more sort of industrialized culture may not want to shift that. So we have to sort of re-envision different alternatives in terms of new ways of creating community, new use of technology, you know, ways of sharing, which is not to say that there shouldn't be any kind of new modes of transportation, but how do we share it so we don't have to have a car for every single individual, you know, which is the kind of model that is being pushed even in places like India or China. And that excessive level of individual consumption cannot be sustained. But if we had transportation, good, efficient transportation that uses renewable technology, but it is shared, it's public, so people have access to that. So I think we have to envision sort of new ways of connecting, new ways of creating sustainability and human well-being, in addition to sort of maintaining, you know, the older ways of living that some communities want to continue.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the more promising initiatives of which you're aware that, you know, kind of do this envisioning? Because I don't know that the average person, you know, is going to either envision or be in a position to implement their visions. What
yeah,
are some
I think
of the more
it has to start
groups?
From where people are at, you know.
Mm-hmm. But what are some of the things that you could point to give people a sense that, you know, kind of help is on the way?
Right. I mean, I think that I have done work on chronic kidney disease in Sri Lanka, which is rampant among agricultural populations, and it is also attributed to very heavy use of pesticides, you know, many mm-hmm. pesticides that are imported from the northern industrialized countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it is at a very critical point, and there's sort of social movements, you know, trying to put limitations on the import of pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
So the need for organic agriculture is a foregone conclusion. But, you know, they can't shift to organic agriculture, complete organic agriculture overnight. So, again, talking about the middle path, it is how to use certain kinds of chemical pesticides, agro-fertilizers as needed, using mm-hmm. techniques like what is referred to as integrated pest management. So, you know, there are groups and there are activist groups, you know, who are trying to promote that. So I think in most situations, you know, there are in fact alternatives that can be experimented with, you know. And that means, you know, changing our own habits little by little. I mean, the meat consumption is really problematic and is very much a contributor to climate change because of, all the fossil fuel energy that is used, you know, in growing feed for the animals and so on. But it may not be necessary for everyone to give up eating meat altogether, you know. On the one hand, to create, produce meat in a more sustainable way, and also for individuals to, you know, sort of balance the meat consumption with the consumption of other food. So I think that on every level, you know, there are alternatives. But to get to that point, I think that people have to free up their minds and their time. And oftentimes it happens only after somebody reaches a critical point, like they develop cancer or their whole community is affected by a so-called ecological disaster. And this is beginning to happen to more and more people. But before it happens to sort of larger, in a larger sense to communities and individuals, I think that we have to wake up and question, you know, how we live, how we think.
That's very interesting. So, I mean, I think these examples are very kind of concrete and helpful because they give it makes it very specific in terms of, you know, less meat, reducing meat, reducing reliance on. So, you know, in other words, there are small step things that go in the right direction before, you know, one doesn't have to kind of go all the way. I mean, it's kind of interesting because I belong to a food co-op in Brooklyn, and we have a lot of produce that is grown through integrated pest management, as you mentioned. So it's not in the organic certification. You know, to buy, for example, an organic lettuce, I might have to purchase something that came all the way from California and then was carried across the country. And, you know, there are fuel use and costs and everything associated with that. But to get a lettuce grown via integrated pest management, I can probably find something, you know, at certain times of year that comes from my local region. And so that's kind of a really perfect example. Integrated pest management involves the minimal use of certain lower harm pesticides along with other natural substances. So I think it's a perfect example of kind of this small step approach that you're advocating and makes a lot of sense. And that could exist in a lot of different areas.
I think another very important aspect in terms of consumers exercising their power, you know, because that is the way that you can have a direct impact on corporations that produce goods and services. And I think that as consumers, we don't exercise that power that we have, you know, sufficiently. And, you know, that is something that is within our control, but it has to be done collectively. And in terms of things like integrated pest management, I think it has to be sort of approached in a case-by-case approach, you know, and I think that pertains to most of these kinds of decisions, which involve time, and it's a slow process. And that means, you know, having to sort of slow down in order to address that rather than sort of going at rapid pace in one direction. That the process is more important than the end product, and the middle part is more is in the process rather than an end point that we are trying to get to. Because after, say, one uses integrated pest management, maybe you know, the producers could get to a point where they have, they can rely completely on natural fertilizers and pesticides and, you know, mm-hmm. do away with chemical pesticides. But I think a lot of farmers who have been conditioned to see chemical pesticides as an absolute necessity in order to, you know, have bountiful harvest are not going to change overnight, which is what mm-hmm. the researchers and activists in Sri Lanka, for example, are recognizing.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I was very struck by and is your earlier book on colonialism in Sri Lanka. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of a theme in our discussion and also a theme, I believe, in American cultural attitudes is in, you know, the primacy of the individual, mm-hmm. the individual right to X, Y, and Z. And yet, as we look closer into these things, with the stress and the pressures and the breakdowns that are coming more rapidly in our time, both to the system at large and therefore to all of the individuals within it, or most of them, aside from maybe a certain tiny percentage, you know, we don't really, we're not as free as we're kind of addicted to believing. And I wonder if there are certain ways in which Americans themselves are colonized while believing themselves free and not really, you know, kind of thinking that. I just, from your perspective of really having looked at colonialism and its effects upon your own country, I'd just be very interested to hear your comments about that.
Right. I think that, you know, this notion of freedom, you know, has to be really questioned. You know, when I was growing up in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. You know, people didn't have much in terms of goods, consumer goods, but people had time, you know, and people visited each other. You know, there was, we weren't so much controlled by the mechanical clock and the calendar. You know, there was a sort of a more fluidity to life, to the flow of life. And mm-hmm. even in Sri Lanka now, you know, that's changed because it's very much a part of the globalized culture and economy. And mm-hmm. time is really what life is, you know, how we spend our time. And so in that sense, people are not free. We are so much tied to all our gadgets and consumption. And I think that we have to really question freedom and the very meaning of human life. So the colonialism is not simply about political economic exploitation, but it is also about transformation of culture and psychology. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, all these sort of interconnected problems that we are facing in the world today, you know, really forces us to ask these sort of fundamental questions, you know, about mm-hmm. what does it mean to be human? You know, what does it mean to be a species in nature, you know, which we are almost losing right now, you know?
Mm-hmm. So how, what would be kind of ways that American attitudes, you know, Americans have been colonialized, if one could say that they mm-hmm. have been to any degree. What would that look like? You know, have we been colonialized and, you know, or colonized? And what would be the signs of that that an ordinary person might recognize?
Well, I think that, in a sense, this model of globalization that we have, you know, globalization in itself is not bad, but the particular model of globalization which we have in place, you know, colonizes everybody, you know, our mm-hmm. minds and the way we live. And that needs to be questioned. I think we have to start with our own lives mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, what do we really want, you know, and how do we free up the time to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, what are our basic needs in addition to the material needs in terms of emotional and social needs? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have to sort of introduce these questions into the educational process, especially starting at a younger age, because right now, starting at a younger age, the children are so connected to the technology that, you know, they don't really they are becoming oblivious to the environment, not just mm-hmm. the natural environment, but the social environment. And mm-hmm. we can't blame the children for being so hyper-connected to technology, because who put that technology in the hands of children, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, that is a basic place to start, first with mm-hmm. ourselves, and then just even having more conversations with people, you know. Mm-hmm. Back in Sri Lanka, still people talk to each other more. People talk about politics. People talk about what is, and they are much more aware of what is even happening in the world. In mm-hmm. the U.S., you know, people are so busy and so disconnected that you don't sort of have many spontaneous discussions with mm-hmm. each other about our mm-hmm. own lives, you know, and mm-hmm. also it's part of fear. Now, you know, with the government shutdown, you know, people, instead of sort of opening up and talking to each other, it's like some people support it and other people don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's increased the polarization of the society rather than people coming together, seeing this as a common problem, you know, that mm-hmm. we don't have a functioning government right now. There are people who won't be able to pay their bills because, you know, they are furloughed, you know. I mean, this is a real crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be more public discussion about it and not wait for the answers to come from the outside, you know. I think that people need to be more engaged, you know, even if to use the cliche empowered, but first we mm-hmm. need to be more engaged, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you, and, you know, I am very pro-engagement, and, you know, what is the, I mean, I think engagement kind of confers several benefits. One thing is that it gets you involved in participating and possibly changing the
mm-hmm.
system. But it also has social benefits, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it? That's what I've found, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because you meet people, you get involved with people, there's a common sense of purpose, you know. And it's one that's meaningful because it's helpful to people and to communities rather than, you know, something that just kind of feels good for today, and you know, then, you know, from there we you know, you know, it was a phrase during the French Revolution when, or, you know, one of the kings said, après moi le déluge, you know,
mm-hmm.
like after me everything blows up and falls apart. I think that even though people may not consciously recognize all the risks why that could be happening, on some level we feel it, and it causes, you know, uneasiness. Do you agree? I mean,
oh, absolutely. I think that mm-hmm. people are afraid of being political, but
mm-hmm.
the fact is that we are political anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we don't speak up,
right.
we are then being political by taking a particular position, by
right.
supporting a particular way of doing things. So I think, and also people feel that they have to take sort of absolutist stances, whereas, you know, we have to keep an open mind that
mm-hmm.
we can change our minds as we get more information on more perspective, you know. And that's also where, for me, the middle path comes in, where we are not like either this or that, but we are mm-hmm. open, our minds are open, our hearts are open, which is, I think, even more important, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is no dualism between what we call political, or if you want to use the term spiritual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The political is spiritual, the spiritual is political.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more about, you know, how we conduct ourselves. So
mm-hmm.
I think that there's too many fears and too much conditioning of our minds, you know, what it means to be a citizen or participate in a democracy. You know, it's not just about the vote. It is about the engagement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, well, thank
you.
I think it's really beautiful and, you know, a lovely way to kind of wrap up and conclude our program. You know, you're really presenting a very integral point of view, and I just want to take the time to thank you, Asoka Bhandarge, for being with me today on Connect the Dots. And I want to point readers, listeners, to her wonderful book, Sustainability and Well-Being, The Middle Path to Environment, Society, and the Economy. It's just published late this last spring, very current, addressing all of these issues from her work as a policy analyst, professor, consultant, organizer, and researcher. If you like this show, make sure to like us on iTunes and pass it along to others. And look out for my blogs on Alternet, EcoWatch, and the Huffington Post, as well as tune in next week to our next edition of Connect the Dots with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Thank you for being with us today, listeners, and be well.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.